Alan Gerganis has chosen a 99-year-old war widow, nearly blind and living in a nursing home, to be the voice of his first novel, Oldest Living Confederate Widow Tells All. Lucy Morrison's husband joined the Confederate Army when he was 13, and even though the war ended for the North and South, it was never over for him. Through the bits and pieces of Lucy's memory, we learn the story of their stormy marriage. Alan Gerganis has written for Atlantic, Harper's, Paris Review, and The New Yorker. He teaches writing at Sarah Lawrence College. Gerganis had his own war experiences 100 years after the Civil War. Back in the 60s, he was drafted and signed up with the Navy. While he waited to be shipped off to Vietnam, he spent some time reading in a Long Beach, California library. It was there that he discovered in a 1790 census register that his family in North Carolina had owned slaves.
The 1790 census listed not just the names, but the number of members of the household, black and white, the number of head of livestock, the number of acres owned. And I found, along with my great-great-grandmother and great-grandmother's names and facts, statistics about the slaves that had been owned by my great-grandfather. This had never been mentioned. It was a kind of understood secret. But the idea that my own relatives had participated in slavery in this direct way brought the fact home to me in a way that was extraordinarily disturbing and alarming.
It created a kind of moral dilemma for you, as you write about it, but this was something that happened 100 years ago. I mean, in a sense, you could say that you had nothing to do with it. I mean, it was part of your family's past, but that wasn't you.
That's one way of approaching it, and I think a lot of people, especially in our current age, tend to approach things in precisely that kind of, what seems to me, kind of facile, pleasure-bound, pleasure-determined manner. Maybe the fact of being from the South, with its sense of history, its sense of lineage.
Why was this a family secret? Why was it something, as you say, that everyone knew about but no one talked about?
I think it got to be a habit after the war not to mention having owned slaves in precisely the same way, perhaps, that, and this is, again, an overstatement, perhaps, but I doubt it, the way Germans don't mention Uncle Fritz being the head of the local SS. I mean, you say he had a distinguished military career, and you say we were terribly good to all the people who worked for us, but you don't say all the people we owned. So one of my ambitions for the book was to incorporate these lives that had been tacitly involved in my life, but in fact left off the record.
Do you think that family secrets and what families don't say is actually more important than what is said? That somehow what is withheld is really what's important?
I think one of the things that sort of fascinates me most about fiction and about life is how none of us can really keep a secret.
And yet none of us really tell all.
That's right. Absolutely. It's a curious paradox that the more you want to hide something, the more apparent it becomes to anybody who's willing to notice. So that the issue of secrecy is curious in a town such as the one I grew up in, which was 65% black. And yet that major proportion of the population had very little control or visibility. There was not a society page in the local paper that allowed a black bride or groom to appear, so that it was as if 65% of the town were, in fact, a kind of shadow world, mm-hmm. a kind of invisible parallel world that was summoned only when you needed a floor cleaned or only when something needed doing in the yard that was much too difficult for oneself.
You say that guilt is a flat-footed emotion and not worthy of being written about. What emotions are worth writing about and worth writing about when it comes to a situation like this, or when we look back into our past and we see slavery and other things that we might be ashamed of?
That's a wonderful question. It's a novel of a question, in fact. The whole scheme is there. My first I'm sounding very sententious, talking about my first memory. I'm 41 years old. It's not as if I'm some 99-year-old war widow who's allowed to tell these things, but you did ask.
That will come later.
That'll happen. My first memory of another human being is of a black woman holding me in her arms. And most of my very early infant memories are of black people being nice to me, probably changing my diapers, but more specifically rocking me in a rocking chair, which I now have in my grungy New York apartment and sit and rock in, hoping to reconstitute some of the early comfort. They were models for me, these people in the foreground with white parents peeking over their shoulders periodically, for what one human being could give another in terms of comfort and safety. So that was the beginning. The guilt is something that comes later. And finally, I think there's an adult attempt to reconcile the two elements, to have the ambition, which is an enormous one, an enormously difficult one to implement between black Americans and white Americans, to honor each other, to see each other, to admit to the difficulty of both sides of the struggle, and not to affix blame only, but to understand that it's a human arrangement as well as an economic necessity that brought us together, and that we have to make concessions and we have to learn to live together. And in some ways, we have to honor each other's mythology. And I think one thing that we writers can do is, by telling the truth, bump up against the possibility of a new kind of mythology.
And I suppose telling the truth, whatever that is, or however you get to the truth, has to do with memory and remembering. But as we all know, memory is subjective, it's selective. It usually is there to serve us and to make some truth about how we live now. And this, in part, is what your book is about as well, is how we do and don't remember, and what the difference is, I suppose.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, one wants, in a tour guide and a witness, one wants somebody who is not just following the script that the DAR has approved for all docents who show people through the big house of American history. Yeah. One wants somebody who is able to say, Thomas Jefferson quite probably had a black slave mistress and had children by her, and this is the door through which she entered his bedroom at Monticello. I remember, as a kid, being taken through Monticello on a tour. I was a firebrand little snotty 14-year-old who'd read this fact about Mr. Jefferson, who remains one of the most admirable and dimensional people that I've ever read about. And I said to the High Church Episcopal Club lady who was showing people through Monticello on alternate Tuesdays, is that the door the slave mistress came through?
In your loudest voice.
That's right. With my parents standing directly beside me, and then even more distant from me as they tried to eliminate themselves from any contact with me, the club lady gave one look at me and said, "In the next room, we will see the music stand that Mr. Jefferson designed for his daughter."
That's what happens to history, isn't it?
That's right.
We kind of plaster over it.
Absolutely. So my fantasy was, how about if we find a person who has been left out of American history in the record book way, but who, in her watchfulness and in her detachment and in the very fact that she's ignored and is just a silent watcher in the corner, has in fact seen more of it in a more dimensional and balanced way than any of the footnoted participants in so-called history actually have been.
Why did you choose the voice of a 99-year-old woman to tell this story?
The advent of the novel in some ways involved getting a flash, an image of a killing at a watering hole, partly based on the Thomas Aiken's watering hole painting of the gentleman and the dog all swimming together amicably. I don't quite understand how that very peaceable picture could become an image of war, but that's in fact what happened. It's a voice of a woman who is funny and detached, completely passionate, completely involved because she's been completely left out and has chosen to be completely involved. a widow, a mother of nine, a resident of a small town. And it seemed to me the perfect witness for these cataclysmic events, which, as I try to suggest in the book, and which everybody knows who's thought about it for a second, are in fact very small town, small time, domestic and human events.
She says at the very end, "Well, I've told you all, or most, or some of what I had to say."
Exactly.
Do you think that she withheld and that we withhold stuff just because we need it for ourselves?
I think so. I think secrets are enormously important. And as we said earlier, the secrets you think you're keeping are frequently the ones that are public knowledge. And the ones that you think are public knowledge are, in fact, your secrets. It's the way all of us, in some ways, want to be loved for the person we aren't. I mean, how many times have you heard a great beauty say, "I'm so intelligent and nobody recognizes it"? And how many times have you heard somebody who's brilliant say, "If I had long legs and blonde hair, I would be the happiest person in the world"? It's all about opposites meeting perpetually.
Well, I can't tell you what a pleasure it was for me to talk with you today, and I thank you very much.
Thank you. I enjoyed it enormously.